Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout.com, a gathering place for people who love movies. Sign up for free at filmspotting.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Matty Robinson. Coming up on this abbreviated Thanksgiving edition of the show, our review of the new experimental Bob Dylan biopic, I'm Not There, plus Adam's conversation with the film's writer-director, Todd Haynes.
We'll also hear music from Dan Byrne, but first, I am Sparta Wolf.
Nice.
They say you have a monster here. They say your lands are cursed.
There have been many brave men who have come. But in the morning, there was nothing left but blood on the floor. And the benches. And the walls.
I am Beowulf. I will kill your monster.
We're going to spend the bulk of this segment on I'm Not There, but Maddie, you demanded that we talk about Robert Zemeckis' digitally enhanced live-action 3D adaptation of the epic Old English poem Beowulf. Our listeners, for the most part, agreed with you and demanded that we talk about it as well. So to get us started, here are some thoughts from Andy G. in the Film Spotting message boards. Andy writes, I work for a major CG animation company, and we all went together to see it in 3D. We agreed that the quality of the CG, while good, is nowhere near as good as it can be, and that all the cast still look like they walked out of the uncanny valley. The more real CG characters get, the more soulless they are revealed to be. The world they inhabit felt strangely small. They are under threat, but what is it that is under threat exactly? The king, played by Anthony Hopkins in the film, seems to live on some farm or something. There's no sense of a wider world around them. You don't feel any empathy for the characters. Who are these people? And there's no humor, except for, Andy suggests, the unintentional kind. Even the 3D, which is kind of cool for a while, is distracting by the end. I just wanted to take the glasses off and get a proper look at the screen. But Andy does conclude he didn't hate the film, he was never bored, and was interested to see how it would all work out to the end. Maddie, were you rewarded for your interest in this dazzling spectacle, or are you pretty much on the same page as Andy?
I'm completely on the same page. I mean, this is why, basically, I have seen my future. I am destined to be the dorky dad embarrassing his kids with the black socks and sandals, because I was completely oblivious about this film. I saw the trailer.
Mm-hmm.
Honest to God, I thought they were real people. I had no idea it was computers until someone wrote in, I guess, 2 weeks ago and said, you know, this is from Zemeckis. It's the same thing as the Polar Express.
You're even more out of touch than I expected.
I know, exactly. I had no idea. And so I go, and it's this computer-generated, I mean, these sort of avatars for their characters, and I could care less. I really, really could care less. And I think it's funny because the last 3D film that I saw was Captain EO at Disneyland, directed by Sofia Coppola's dad. And I think it's funny, I think it's apropos that that's the last 3D movie I saw, because all the characters in Beowulf look like they just stepped off the Pirates of the Caribbean ride. I mean, they look like pink little digits, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I could have cared less. There was no heart behind them at all. I mean, it was like watching a video game.
Yeah, it is in many ways, which is another one of the criticisms that was lobbed at 300, including by me. And this film does feel similar, of course, in many ways to that Zack Snyder film, which neither of us liked. I really am with you, and I had a similar reaction to Andy. Maybe not a big surprise here. I can't say I was never bored by it, because I was definitely bored at times, but it did mostly maintain my interest, and there are some dazzling 3D moments. I have to say, I mean, you can have fun with some of this stuff, and I remember you saying that, hey, you saw the dragon in the trailer and thought it looked cool.
Yeah.
And the dragon is cool.
Oh, it's a cool dragon.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really cool scene.
It's a good-looking dragon.
Yeah, and the sequence we get at the end does work there. So there is some great 3D stuff with the blood spattering and coming out at you in the audience. It does work. I can't imagine anyone going to see this and watching it in 35 millimeter.
You have to see it in 3D.
I can't imagine what the allure of watching it in 35 could possibly be. But Andy's right, the world does seem really small, which I'm guessing it doesn't in the epic poem, and I don't think that the animation does traverse that uncanny valley that Andy mentions. And the best explanation I found for that phenomenon was in an article on Slate a few years back, and the writer said that when an android like C-3PO looks somewhat human, we cut it a lot of slack. It seems cute. We don't care that it's only 50% human-like, but when a robot becomes 99% lifelike, so close that it's almost real, we focus on that missing 1%. That's the same effect you get watching these characters. We sit there and focus on what is missing. And what is missing in these characters is true expression. Any kind of life whatsoever.
It's like they almost get there, but then there's just a little herky jerk in their movement, and you're completely alienated.
Yeah, it's true. And every time the movie, for example, cuts to Robin Wright Penn as the queen, Anthony Hopkins' wife,
she's
in this
put
film,
on a couple pounds.
Maybe, according to this film, she looks like Jake Gyllenhaal in Rendition. She's just a blank slate. Oh, is she happy?
Ouch.
Is she sad? Is she turned on? Is she disgusted? I don't know, because she looks the same in every single shot. The CG just cannot pick up the nuance of a performance. And I know that might be fine for people who want to just go see the cool dragon and see the spectacle of it. I'm sorry, I want the nuance and the cool dragon, and this movie doesn't have it.
No, exactly. And Angelina Jolie, I think there was just too much buildup.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's naked, but that's about it. After the first, she looks like Angelina Jolie for a second, and then she just becomes a sort of computer blob. And completely untitillating.
Yeah, it's true, and no pun intended, I'm sure, there, Maddie. But
sorry.
I know it may seem contradictory, but Beowulf is a lot more interesting the more simple he is. When you hear him early in the film saying things like, "Tonight will be different. I am the Ripper, the Terror, the Slasher. I am the Teeth in the Darkness. My name is Strength and Lust and Power. I am Beowulf." It's kind of campy, which many aspects of this film are, but that's a lot more interesting to hear than watching Beowulf in the second half of this film sitting around like an old rock star lamenting his glory days. The movie slows down to an absolute crawl in the second half before the dragon shows up. And the only thing I can really say I liked about this movie was watching John Malkovich camp it up a little bit, be John Malkovich. Whether he's trying to be intentionally funny or not, I don't know. But there is something fun about just sitting there watching him say his lines like, "Oh, Beowulf, I am so impressed with you."
Well,
you know, in that Malkovich
thing,
way.
They didn't go far enough on the camp value. I mean, there totally could have been this could have been a great tongue-in-cheek film, and I think it starts off that way, but you hit the nail on the head. I mean, this thing just dies by about the last quarter of the film.
People are always talking about freedom. Freedom to live a certain way. Of course, the more you live a certain way, the less it feels like freedom. Me, I can change during the course of a day. I wake and I'm one person, and when I go to sleep, I know for certain I'm somebody else.
Adam, in talking to my friend Charles, avid listener of the show, I told him I saw I'm Not There, Todd Haynes' latest sort of Fantasia Bob Dylan biopic, and I explained how the movie unfolded, and he responded that he probably wasn't going to see it because while he loves Dylan's music, he wasn't much interested in Dylan the myth.
Hmm.
And I thought that was pretty well put. I mean, this is a film that draws from Dylan's life and sort of reimagines him with the character of Dylan presented in several incarnations, sort of as a prophet, a movie star, and lots more. My question to you is pretty simple. The studios have anguished over who is the audience member for this film. And I want to know, for those not versed in Dylan history, is this film worth their time? And as a whole, does Haynes' experiment work?
Well, speaking to that concern, it is worth noting that just this morning we got a press release pointing out that the Weinstein Company, in participating movie theaters nationwide, is going to distribute liner notes for this film, tying in with Dylan and the liner notes to his album, but really, of course, trying to give people some kind of basis to follow this movie. So they definitely are concerned. But to answer the question personally, you would have gotten a much different answer if you'd asked me this 2 weeks ago. I have to admit, the first time I saw this movie in Toronto, I did not get it at all. And Matt Singer, our friend from IFC News, is going to hate me when he hears this, because we talked on the phone the night before our screening here in Chicago. We spent 10 minutes going over how underwhelming we thought the film was. It was too slow and meandering. The experiment didn't really seem to work because the pieces didn't necessarily fit together unless maybe you were this huge Dylan fan and got not only all of the literal references, but all of the metaphorical ones too. It just didn't work for us. And I think I even told you right before the movie started that if you were looking for any real insight into Dylan as an artist, this wasn't your movie. Well, I hope you don't hold that against me now, Maddie, because I have to admit now, watching the movie for the second time, everything clicked into place. I think beyond the fact that it was the 23rd of 23 movies I saw in 5 days in Toronto, I was trying too hard the first time around to see the significance of everything, and I just didn't let the individual stories unfold. I didn't see the humor, for example, in the opening sequence of the 11-year-old African-American boy traveling around the country pretending to be Woody Guthrie. This time I did. And the biggest thing, though, for me is the first time I saw it as Haynes more experimenting than anything, playing with these shifting personas, but I didn't really see the pieces as part of a larger whole. This time the transitions from persona to persona made complete sense to me. I understood why one character ended and the next character picked up in response. And I do hope that not only the diehard Dylan fans will embrace this movie, but I hope people who are just curious about Dylan or curious about cinema and how you may be able to transcend the traditional biopic will seek it out.
Oh, I'm with you 100%, and I do hope people check this film out. You know, we reviewed Across the Universe earlier this fall, and for me, that movie sort of exemplified one way you can go with this kind of material, certainly the more capitalistic route. You listen to an artist's body of work, you attach a trite storyline to it, and then you repackage it for us. I mean, that's what you're seeing all over Broadway now, and that's because nostalgia is an easy sell. And if they ever make Pink Floyd The Wall, the Broadway musical, of course, I'll be the first one to line up and see it. Look at VH1's content, their retro programming, you know, I Love the 80s. Basically, it's 30 minutes of someone going, remember when we had color forms and He-Man? Wasn't that cool? I mean, we just eat that stuff up. But I digress. This film goes completely opposite to that. Here, rather than repackaging something we already know to make a buck off of it, he takes an artist's body of work, and I'm going to say perhaps the greatest songwriter of the 20th century. Irving Berlin fans can feel free to pen their hate mail now.
I'm sure we'll get a ton of mail.
Yeah, and uses his music as an inspiration to make his own piece of art. He takes a blank canvas, and he just gets all Jackson Pollock up in here, you know? And that's what I like to see. He throws everything he can think of and sees what sticks. No, this film isn't perfect. It fails miserably in parts, but that's okay. I like what it is, the amalgamation of what it is, a celebration, an examination, a condemnation, all kinds of different things. And for me, in the end, it was really exhilarating.
Yeah, it was for me too. And like I said, the second time around, it really did work for me on that same level that you're talking about, as this amalgamation, as its own piece of art. Because what's fascinating is what he understands, of course, about Dylan is that Dylan was this shapeshifter, someone who defied any kind of labeling. And when you watch No Direction Home, for example, the Martin Scorsese documentary, it's really good. And it starts with this evocation of the lines, No Direction Home. And Dylan saying to the camera, he never really saw himself as someone with a home. He was always traveling somewhere. Well, how do you make a movie about someone who doesn't feel like they ever had a beginning or they ever had an origin and that they're actually searching for that origin? This is how you do it. You understand that this is a guy who, again, defied that kind of labeling. And so I really just feel like he got that aspect so right here. And I mentioned how I made connections that second time that I didn't make before. And I'll give you an example. I think the weakest link in the film is still the Richard Gere sequence.
Oh, I love the Richard Gere
really?
Sequence.
Really? Okay. Well, the first time I really just saw it as the most out there in terms of seeing it tie in at all to Dylan's life, with Gere playing this outlaw in seclusion, Billy the Kid really hiding out. And again, it just took too long, and I just didn't get it in terms of Dylan's career. And the second time, what I realized, first of all, more than any incomprehensibility or the fact that it's slow, the going to Acapulco sequence, Calexico, Jim James, the lead singer from My Morning Jacket,
so
do
gorgeous.
This production of going to Acapulco, and it's just absolutely mesmerizing. It's really great. It really affected me this time around. But then there were these visual connections that I just didn't get the first time. This amazing shot early in the sequence where we go, I believe, from a television set's picture of Vietnam, a really close-up shot that really distorts the jungle. And then we cut to Gere, and we see him looking off into the distance at his landscape. And the way Ed Latchman, Todd Haynes' brilliant cinematographer, shoots the scene and the way it goes in on this tight close-up, this extreme close-up of the landscape, you make the connection to the Vietnam War, to the shot we just saw. I don't need to know, as I learned later, that of course what Todd Haynes is talking about is that at this time, Dylan was this guy who Woodstock's literally going on, the big festival is going on in his backyard, this big anti-war protest. He's across the hill doing his own thing, couldn't care less. That's what he's trying to draw on. But you don't need to see that. You just, as a film, what you are seeing on screen, you make the connection from scene to scene. You see that, you understand that Gere's character, the outlaw here, has turned his back on that scene. And it makes sense, whether you know exactly what it's referencing in Dylan's career or not. It's a beautiful moment.
Well, I'm glad you're living in the mess a little bit, because you and I are certainly different that way. I mean, you lay your socks out every day. I'm lucky if I bathe. And I think that the more abstract that this film was, the happier I was.
Yeah.
The less that I was able to connect the dots. I liked living in the abstract, living and breathing in the unknown of this film. The more it was out there, the more I was in the dark, just living along with these images, the more I enjoyed this film. Mm-hmm. The more I know about Dylan's life and actually could recognize on screen, like, say, the electric guitar at Newport episode, the way that was handled, I didn't care so much about that. That stuff came across as too obvious. And whereas the more abstract representations, Dylan realized as like a 12-year-old black kid, I just love that. And the Billy the Kid sequence.
Okay.
And the reason is because, I mean, he appears to be living in this town of misfit toys circa 1882. A developer is planning on razing the town to make way for a superhighway or something like that. And for me, at the risk of sounding like I'm interpreting a dream, which, God, I hate it when people explain their dreams to me. I just cannot stand that. But for me, this sort of represented, like you said, the the late 60s, early 1970s, the reflective Dylan.
Yeah.
And I just love the sepia tones that he uses there. And so for me, this film succeeded when it went one step further into the abstract.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Even though I do like those moments, I love the fact that when Dylan, for example, being portrayed as the voice of his generation, he gets Christian Bale, the man with no sense of humor, to play the Dylan with no sense of humor. That really works there. I do like some of those moments, but I agree with you. The more it gets away from Dylan's life, the less we sit there and just try to go, oh, hey, I get that reference.
Exactly.
Getting the references isn't the fun of this film. And the bottom line is, if you want to get the insight into Dylan from the perspective of how did he get from point A to B to C, then watch No Direction Home. Watch a documentary. Yeah. But I don't need to see the sort of behind the music of Dylan's life. And the way Todd Haynes transcended that here, I think absolutely is brilliant. And I love Cate Blanchett, too. I know there's a lot of buzz.
Fantastic.
She gets to play the Dylan, the post Don't Look Back Dylan, who's gone electric and is kind of hopped up on amphetamines. And I love what she does with that character. You actually do forget completely that it's a woman playing the role.
Even more so than Linda Hunt, actually, in The Year of Living Dangerously.
Really?
Watching Year of Living Dangerously, I was always aware that Linda Hunt was a woman.
Yeah.
But to be fair, Blanchett isn't really playing a man.
No.
She doesn't have to play a man.
Right.
This is just sort of, again, an amalgamation of ideas and emotions that he was going through at that time, and it can sort of live in that androgyny.
Yeah, it can. She's not necessarily impersonating Dylan, which is why it works so well, though she hits certain notes, but there's a real anger and frustration to her character that if you watch those same scenes in No Direction Home and you see Dylan plays it much more sarcastic and loose, and he lets his frustration out in terms of his humor. That's not there in Blanchett's performance. She is adding a layer there, and
because
I really think it's great.
That's rule number one in this film. Don't play Dylan. That's the last thing I want to see. That's why Richard Gere succeeds. That's why the black kid succeeds.
Mm-hmm.
I love the
Marcus Carl Franklin, he's amazing.
He's terrific in this film as this kid, and I love it, because the one thing I was able to put together, of course, Dylan is from the great state of Minnesota.
Yeah.
And he's always sort of been accused of living in denial of that fact, of making up a past for himself. And I love that this kid is making up his own history.
In search of
Woody
Guthrie.
Exactly. Yeah. And another rendition that's absolutely fantastic is Ben Whishaw.
Mm-hmm.
He is fantastic. And he just sort of flits in and out.
As this poet kind of under an inquisition.
Yeah, he's the closest thing to a narrator in this film. I think he's terrific. And he actually adopts some of Dylan's mannerisms and the way
and
he
rhetoric,
speaks.
Yeah.
Exactly. The one that didn't work for me, though, was Christian Bale. Because it seemed, again, like he's playing at Dylan.
You know what? You're exactly right, actually. I remember thinking, as much as I love Christian Bale, he's the one working the hardest to be like him. You see him slumped on a stool and he's being interviewed and he's moving around and he's trying to be Dylan, whereas Cate Blanchett is her own character.
And that whole storyline is the most obvious.
Maybe.
I think they kind of
spoof. They do it like a documentary.
There. Yeah, it doesn't quite work. Luckily, it doesn't get a whole lot of screen time.
No, it doesn't. But it sounds like we are obviously in agreement here. I'm Not There, a film really worth checking out if you have the patience for it. Both Beowulf and I'm Not There are in theaters now. You will, of course, find I'm Not There on a lot fewer screens. But if you agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voicemail.
Time for a quick break. When we come back, Todd Haynes explains what possessed him to cast Cate Blanchett as Bob Dylan. Stay with us.
and speaking later and later in the day. Most days I don't talk till maybe 8 o'clock at night. It keeps me whole, keeps me holy, keeps me well in the mines. Even when I'm on the road, keeps me coming up for air, keeps me airing out some coma, keeps me cool. Place I could go home. And every girl I kiss, well, I just cross her off my list. I don't go far, I just go crazy. I buried all of my old clothes out in some field in West Des Moines. And if you judge me tonight, judge me by the songs I write. That's who I am to you.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. Before we get to my conversation with director Todd Haynes, we did want to take a look at last week's poll question. And, of course, it does tie in with this film, I'm Not There. We wanted to know how you felt about this movie, how excited you were. So we said, Todd Haynes' I'm Not There opens November 21st. I'll be there because, and here were your choices, the concept intrigues me, the cast is excellent, Dylan is a god, Haynes is a god, or It Ain't Me, Babe, It Ain't Me You're Looking For. Maddie, how did it come out?
Well, I was a little bit surprised, but not really. I mean, it's a polarizing film.
Yeah,
I think these numbers indicate that. The concept intrigues me, number one, at 42%. It Ain't Me, Babe, It Ain't Me You're Looking For, close behind at 30%. The Cast is Excellent comes in at 13%, tied with Dylan is a God at 13%. Haynes is a God, I guess that was
only
pretty
2%.
Expected, only 2%.
Yeah, but I was surprised too. I did expect The Concept Intrigues Me to win, but I didn't realize that 30%, the next highest vote would be that people aren't interested in this film
at
all.
And it's really hard to recommend if you're not interested in it. I have to say that. There are moments that are really going to challenge your patience. There were certainly people that left during our screening.
Really?
Yeah.
There were? I didn't notice.
Oh, yeah, these old fogies, they were out of there.
Oh, you're right. Actually, I do remember
Maybe
that
Maybe they
now.
Just had to use the bathroom.
Maybe they did. You never know. But some older folks did walk out. Not a big surprise, you're right, with this film. Let's move on to this week's poll question then, Maddie. We want to know, of the movies reviewed by Film Spotting this year, the biggest turkey so far was, of course, Turkey, tying in with Thanksgiving for those of you celebrating out there, as we will be this week. What's the biggest turkey of the year, Maddie?
Is it Pirates of the Caribbean 3? Fracture, Across the Universe, Spider-Man 3, or Transformers?
Maddie, where are you going to vote?
I would have, of course, I gave it no stars. I have to go with Across the Universe.
Okay, you did give it no stars. That's true. This is a tough one. I did initially want to leave out Spider-Man 3 because I'm afraid it's going to run away with the poll, but we will see. This is a tough one for me in terms of expectations for the film. I'd have to go with either Fracture or Across the Universe. Yeah. I knew that Across the Universe could be a train wreck, but I was really curious. With Fracture, I thought it would be a much better thriller than it was, and I just think it's really bland and kind of a waste of time there with Anthony Hopkins and Ryan Gosling. So I'd go one of those two ways, probably with Across the Universe, though, as well. So those are our votes. Go to filmspotting.net and make your voice heard. You mentioned that you found yourself coming back to Dylan at a time in your life when you were looking for change. I'm wondering, was there something specific, though, about Dylan that you were turning to? Something that prompted that?
I don't think I knew it at the time. I think it was just a symptom of a phase, of a transitional period in my life that just evolved as this desire to listen to Dylan. And it was Dylan music that I had listened to before. But looking back on it, I think it was very clear. I was first a fan in high school, and I hadn't really listened to that music for 20 years. And I think I needed that kind of guarantee in the voice and in the fearlessness in that voice and in those recordings. You know, the same kind of excitement was around the corner for me that you feel when you're young, that you have a harder time feeling when you get older, you know, and that I needed that like little kick in the ass to get me from, move me from point A to point B in my life.
When you sent the one sheet description to Jeff Rosen, Dylan's longtime manager, was the shape-shifting personas aspect of it always there?
Yeah. That was the sort of urge to make a movie about Dylan came as this concept to split him up into parts, into different people, different stories. And that was the concept that we took to Jeff. It was later that same year, 2000.
Were all of the personas always there, or did some evolve out of the writing?
It's remarkably close when you read the little one-sheet line descriptions that I gave them when I wrote the thing up for Dylan to read, including things like, you know, Jude, the character that Kate Blanchett would eventually play, is described, this character would be portrayed by a woman who would resemble the real Dylan more than any other in the film. So even that was somehow there, which surprised me when I look back on the sheet later. There was one additional character, this guy Charlie, that was supposed to just be a little one-off story that would come out of one of Woody's tales of his past, and it was just meant to be a little silent screen vignette that depicted this Dylan who, when he first came to Greenwich Village, he was continually described as Chaplin-esque when he'd perform his shows. He had this sort of innocent humorousness that would come out on stage, and the way he dressed as well. So this was a little nod to that. It kind of got absorbed into the Woody story, and you see him now dressed as Chaplin toward the end of the film.
You mentioned Kate Blanchett. What was it, do you recall at the time, that really hit you, that made you think you wanted a woman in that role?
It was really simple. It was almost superficial. It was really just about trying to unlock what I saw as the unique strangeness of Dylan's physical state in 1966 when he plugged in electric. It's such a famous moment, great moments in rock history. Mm-hmm. Dylan plugs in electric, Dylan with the big hair and the Ray-Bans and the skinny body. And almost by definition, those great moments lose their original blood and guts and what was at stake and what it must have been like. It's almost like when people say, when I first heard the Beatles, I pulled my car over to the side of the road because I'd never heard anything like it before. And I always am like, oh my God, I wish I could know what that would have been like to have never heard anything like the Beatles before and to hear that, you know? And so in a way, it was a similar strategy that I had to do something extra to underscore Dylan's physical androgyny and the sort of threat of his physical state in 1966.
Do you think it's the process itself that's at fault?
Who cares what I think? I'm not the president. I'm just a storyteller, man. That's all I am.
Well, I presume at the very least that you care something about what you sing every night.
Well, how can I answer that if you got the nerve to ask me?
Do you know, I am convinced of one thing. You either do truly care about nothing at all, or tremendously much that people think so.
And you ask for my time?
And you mentioned the note, finding that note that she was going to be the one who resembled Dylan the most. And I think one of the misconceptions about the film that a lot of people maybe have is that these are all variations on Dylan, which they are, but I mean that there was this perception that it was like an African-American boy is playing Dylan. And of course, he's not really. It's more metaphorical, but there are some who clearly are playing Dylan. Did you ever consider having them all be more on that metaphorical realm and not impersonating, in a way, Dylan?
Well, no. I think what's funny about all biopics that this film just separates into separate columns is that we're always mixing the famous moments that we've all seen before of Johnny Cash at San Quentin Prison, mm-hmm. and the photographs that are associated with that, with things we've never seen before, Johnny Cash in bed with his wife and what they talk about, or Johnny Cash at age 14, or things that we do not know what they are. And these movies try to seamlessly weave the famous, the known, with the unknown, the private, you know, and create a kind of narrative whole that gives us the sense of a complete life. I just take these things, the famous Dylan moments, because all of the Dylans in the film are tailored after very specific and concrete Dylans. And one, yeah, is played by an African-American boy, but he's modeled entirely after the clothes, style, gestures, and stories and narrative that Dylan would would be pouring out when he was a young Woody Guthrie wannabe in the early 60s.
You mentioned Johnny Cash, and we've certainly seen these biopics recently, like Walk the Line and Ray, and this has become a pretty familiar genre at this point. Was there at all on your part an intention to, from an intellectual point of view as a filmmaker, to say, I'm going to completely put the biopic on its head?
Maybe there was. It was really more out of more than out of a sort of negative position of wanting to strike out in a different way and say no to this. It was really in a positive position about wanting to embrace what I felt was getting to the core of Dylan. And the only way to do him and his career and his work justice would be to really thoroughly commit to the different places he occupied in his life. And to me, they're not just when I wrote and put together the film, I gave as much importance to his creative life as his lived life. And I used the places where those two things crossed as my material. You know, so that's why what he wrote about, what he dreamed about, what he fantasized about, when it overlapped with the fact that he happened to settle down in Woodstock and live the country life for a few years, then it gave me sort of liberty to turn that story into a Western. And he did appear in Pat Garrett, Billy the Kid, the mm-hmm. Peckinpah film.
Sure.
But he also traveled back in his mind creatively to roots music and traditional music and all the sources of American popular music and used that to kind of create a whole new genre for himself, a whole new series of records that reflected those ideas and those fantasies.
I know at first, quite understandably, you felt a responsibility to kind of get things right, so to speak, telling the story of Dylan, this legendary figure. How much of a relief was it then to hear from Jeff Rosen that, you know what, you've kind of got carte blanche to be as imaginative as you want? Was that a relief?
Oh, my God, it was an amazing thing. Because I did. I mean, it wasn't like I felt I had to explain Dylan to the world. I felt like I more wanted to find a cinematic parallel to getting at the core of what he did with popular music, which is no small task. That's an enormous and maybe perhaps impossible demand on myself. But Jeff just said, when I called him and asked him about this, and it was at the point where I was needing to extend the rights for the script writing process, and he said, Todd, you don't have to worry about that stuff. You know, this is your own unique, weird take on Dylan, and that's all you have to worry about. And I'm thinking, this is Dylan's manager telling me this.
Right.
And I just realized I was being given this extraordinary opportunity and this amazing set of conditions where it's almost like the creative freedoms that Jeff is there to protect for his client, he was extending to me, you know, which makes no sense in the business world.
Sure.
But it's been a true privilege to work with Jeff.
I know you read a lot about Dylan. What about the films, Dylan on screen, that we've seen? How much did you turn to those?
I felt I wanted to look at all of them, which meant watching Rinaldo and Clara again, because I saw it when it came out when I was in high school and I was in my first Dylan fandom. I saw Masked and Anonymous, a film that Dylan had apparently written and stars in. But obviously two of the my favorite examples of Dylan on film are, of course, Don't Look Back, the Penny Baker documentary from 1965, and then this unbelievable, never officially released documentary called Eat the Document that came out. Well, never came out, but it was filmed the following year when Dylan was doing his Electric tour, also by Penny Baker, but all in color. And a lot of the footage that you see in No Direction Home, Scorsese's documentary of Dylan in the 1966 concert, are outtakes from that footage for Eat the Document. But it's this completely experimental. People can probably find it on the internet or in the ways that you can today. Totally experimental thing that Dylan actually edited somewhat himself in Woodstock with some other people when he was recovering from his motorcycle crash. But it's an enigmatic, beautiful, mysterious documentary right from this very famous time in his life.
Don't Look Back, of course, is a classic documentary by Penny Baker, and I have to admit, unfortunately, I just saw it for the first time maybe a year and a half ago. I'm really curious how you then, someone who had seen it before and now watching it with the eyes of someone who's making a film about Dylan, what that process is like and what jumps out at you, what's a surprise, what sticks with you?
I mean, I'd seen it probably a few, many times over in my life because I've been into Dylan since I was young. But every time I see it, I probably pulled out a different thing and was looking at a different thing and trying to find, because I was always in the process of trying to find the best examples of certain events or moments in Dylan's life or ideas about him vis-a-vis each of my stories, and that I would then put into the right story. And one thing, a lot of people say the Jude section, which is shot in black and white, the part that stars Cate Blanchett in the film, is an homage to the style
sure.
of Don't Look Back.
It makes you think of it. You can't help it.
You can't help but think of it because it's black and white. It's like there's all these hotel room scenes mm-hmm. and press conferences. But actually my goal in trying to find a style for each of the stories was to try to find what the music was, the style of the music was at that particular time. And look at all the films from the 60s as my palette, the stuff I could draw from, right? But Don't Look Back is a classic. First I was like, okay, I'll do Jude like Don't Look Back. It'll uh-huh. be great. It'll be really cool. And I was like, wait a minute. Don't Look Back is a classic cinema verite, you know, documentary. Realism, you know, handheld cameras, letting the scenes play out, all this stuff. But the music of the Jude period is Dylan Electric, Highway 61 Revisited, and Blonde on Blonde, like two albums that are about as far from social realism or cinema verite as you could get.
Mm-hmm.
And so it didn't take long for me to like look at Fellini's 8.5, and there I found this amazing black and white classic from the 60s
yeah.
that is about the artist under siege from the media, being asked, why are you making these movies, these crazy movies, and not like your old movies? And shot in this Baroque, distorted, but gorgeously composed, you know, consumer culture, modern Italy,
mm-hmm.
became our point of reference for the Jude section. So it really isn't Don't Look Back in the end.
I was going to say, even more than Don't Look Back, it is the influence of those European filmmakers,
yeah.
Fellini and also Godard in the film.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, Godard is sort of what we looked at for the Robbie Clare story with Heath Ledger. It sort of tells the personal story of Dylan and his romantic life and struggles to keep his marriage going amid his career.
You mentioned the eclectic nature of Dylan. You really can't classify all of his music and dealing with a lot of different genres over his career. Do you have a favorite? Is there a specific period that is your favorite you like to listen to?
Blonde on Blonde is probably still my favorite.
She takes just like a woman. Yes, she does. She makes love just like a woman. Yes, she does. And she aches just like a woman.
But having kind of lived through all the stories with the actors, with my creative partners, like entered them and exited them and recreated them and found cinematic parallels for them, I have a special relationship with each one. And each of these little genres and categories that he lived through and what he produced, whether it's as a protest singer in the early 60s, a rock and roll singer in the mid-60s, a gospel singer in the late 70s, early 80s, someone reinterpreting traditional music, old-time music. I mean, he's made distinctive contributions in each of these categories, and there's amazing treasures to be found in each of them.
There's a really interesting quote in the press notes where you're talking about Dylan's folk period and then later the Christian period, where the in you kind of found into that was that it was a time when he kind of had all the answers. And I want you to maybe clarify that a little bit, because watching Don't Look Back, for example, he's a guy who is actively trying to push away
Absolutely.
Any notion that he had any of the
Absolutely.
Answers. So is that more of an outward thing, the way everyone saw him as someone with all the answers?
Well, Don't Look Back is a period where he's turning away from the rigidity and the sort of set of requirements that came from being the spokesman of his generation and following a presumed sort of political mandate, the New Left and the Civil Rights era that he obviously was a spokesperson for musically. He really didn't want to become a participant in politically. But Don't Look Back is where those walls are just closing in on him. He would later say that right during Don't Look Back, he was ready to quit music entirely. He was sick of going out and singing these long songs to a silent, reverent audience. You know, he didn't want to be the guy with the answers anymore. But what I found really interesting about both the early, you know, protest period and then the Christian period is that in both cases, he really did ascribe to a doctrine. He really did articulate it exquisitely and become a kind of leader within those movements. Mm-hmm. And he kind of lost a sense of humor, which is something that actually has defined Dylan throughout most of his career. They're some of the most beautiful songs he's written in both the gospel period and the protest period. But they're not as funny. They're not as light. They're not as playful. They're not as whimsical and experimental. And so there's a kind of moral certitude in both those times and a little less playfulness, you know. And it helped me to understand the Christian time. I think that's more where people go head scratching. Mm-hmm. And we all are fine with the civil rights time. Like, that's classic Dylan, you know. But it was helpful to me to draw a connection between the two. And I think it helps us to understand the need to be indoctrinated and the need to have a moral certitude and to feel clarity. And after the 60s and the 70s, a lot of people were going in one way or another to find the answer.
The first time we see Bruce Greenwood's character mm-hmm. in the film, he seems to be echoing the journalist character in Don't Look Back, who's really nagging him for a lot of those answers. And as obnoxious as he is, I can't help but feel, at least myself as a viewer, that there is a frustration watching Dylan where you want him to be able to articulate some of his positions on things,
sure.
even though he doesn't want to.
Absolutely.
Because he certainly does it in his songs. Did you feel ever that same frustration, or did you look at it as that's the enigma that is Dylan that you're trying to explore?
No. I really chose specifically to not make the journalist character, the Mr. Jones character in the film, a buffoon mm-hmm. or a easy target of the so-called establishment or the older generation or these simple lines that were being drawn in the 60s, you know, between different age groups. So therefore, I wanted him to ask good questions that got under mm-hmm. Jude's skin and showed – I mean, Dylan is a fascinating figure who, when he would enter these phases – he really wanted to be able to control the information about his past lives. And, you know, it's remarkable how vulnerable he was to being found out. For instance, when he continued to evade questions about his upbringing and where he came from for years. And finally, in 1963, this Newsweek article came out and revealed that he was a middle-class kid from Minnesota. And that his parents actually had just come when he'd been claiming for years he was an orphan, he was raised in the circus, he had all these outrageous stories. Finally, he's found out, and he was mortified. He felt betrayed. It really took a blow on him, and he would never again trust the media the way he had prior to that event. And you wonder, how could he have been so shocked? It was such an easy thing to find out. Mm-hmm. And he was very famous by this time as a protest singer, you know. So there are ways in which his stubbornness or his inability to kind of acknowledge the games that he's setting up that are easy to see through is kind of remarkable. So you can't help but identify with journalists who want to ask these questions.
Sure. Well, we started out by asking about change and your interest in changing as a filmmaker. And certainly this film deals with the whole aspect of Dylan as a performer constantly reinventing himself. He's a misfit, and all of your characters mm-hmm. seem to definitely be, in a very vague sense, obviously, mm-hmm. misfits. Do you see yourself reinventing yourself or having an interest in doing that with this film or other projects that are coming out?
Well, I do. At a basic level, I find that the sort of historical references of each of the films I've made change radically from film to film, because they're set in different periods. And each time that provides this tremendous and exhilarating opportunity to get into that time mm-hmm. and totally, like, to get into the tissue of it, you know. And usually for me, as a filmmaker, that means, like, examining the cinema from that time and the film language of that time. And literally, like, what kind of lenses did they use and what kind of shots, the duration of shots, how did the cameras move around the actors, how were the narratives constructed. And Far From Heaven, it's a film that we follow very closely, the film style of the 50s. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily that I'm saying this is the way the 50s really were, but I do think that by following the practices and the sort of rules, the visual rules and the narrative rules of a specific time, you do get an understanding of its climate in a way that, you know, is hard to do when you just set out to do it just from the outside in. So each time it gives me this education, this amazing ability to learn about different techniques and periods. And in that way, I learn and I feel completely innocent and naked each time I start the next project. And it's a whole new education each time.
Well, it was a pleasure speaking with you. Best of luck with the film.
Thank you so much. Likewise.
How does it feel?
At the end of my interview with Todd Haynes, Maddie, I had to ask him the obvious question, being that he's now a filmmaker from Portland, if that means that he must get together with Gus Van Sant regularly and drink beers and talk about movies or whatever. And he said, yeah, they actually do hang out quite a bit. We talked a little bit about Paranoid Park, the new Van Sant film that I did see in Toronto and that he loves just as I like very much. And then he mentioned that Gus Van Sant, he has a new movie now in the works. It's finally a done deal. And we did see something about this earlier in the week, a press release. Gus Van Sant's making a version of The Times of Harvey Milk. He's going to make a Harvey Milk biopic, if you will, starring Sean Penn. And I know you were a little bit...
I'm a little bit nervous because...
Unhappy with
I
that.
I don't want... I'm not unhappy. I mean, obviously, I recognize Sean Penn is one of the greatest actors of this generation. But I don't want Harvey Milk to be crying all over the place. And that's what Sean Penn seems to be doing. He's just so heavy when not reined in.
Yeah.
And Harvey Milk was such an energetic, exuberant guy,
sure,
just a force of nature. And I'm hoping Sean Penn doesn't overdo it here.
See, I think if he brings that kind of sweet and lowdown type character with the mustache and that same kind of childlike, a little bit exuberance, I think he can nail Harvey Milk. And so I am really curious. Of course, The Times of Harvey Milk was a documentary we watched ages ago in our documentaries marathon here on Film Spotting. But just an interesting note, a film I definitely am going to look forward to seeing.
Oh,
they start
really excited
shooting it in January. And Maddie, that is our Thanksgiving show.
That's it. That's it for this week. All right, out new this week in wide release, August Rush. I don't know anything about that film. Enchanted, Hitman, This Christmas, and The Mist.
Yeah, the new Stephen King adaptation, Frank Darabont. I actually have been hearing some good things about this film. I'm going to try to check it out over the holiday. Maddie, you should too, if you have some time.
All right, I will try to get there. In limited release, I'm Not There, and Margot at the Wedding, Noah Baumbach's dysfunctional family follow-up to The Squid and the Whale.
Obviously, if you can get out to see I'm Not There, we do suggest that. Also, No Country for Old Men expands to more screens, so check that one out if you can. On next week's show, we will review Margot at the Wedding and possibly get to the fourth film in our Bergman Marathon, Winter Light, and the end of the year onslaught begins with our top five DVDs of 2007, just in time for your holiday shopping lists.
All right. Happy Thanksgiving to all of you who are celebrating this week. Thanks for listening, sending in such great feedback, and really making this show so much fun to do. I wish if I had a picture of you in your Miles Standish outfit and me dressed as Squanto, I would send it out to each and every one of you, but you'll have to make do with a big thank you.
Yeah, that's it, I'm afraid. Thanks specifically to Alex and Angela in our message boards. Frank Huckle, I have to say, he's been invaluable with all our graphics work on our website and helping me out with the Chicago Film Critics Association website, and also Candace Griffiths, who at this point I'm not sure I could live without in doing this show and just about every other aspect of my life. So again, thank you to all of you. Also, thanks to Dan Byrne and Messenger Records for this week's music. Learn more at messengerrecords.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Maddie Robinson. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout. Visit filmspotting.spout.com to discuss this episode. Are you ready, Bob?
Hey, let's say it was poor, man. That's just like your opinion, man.